Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is called practical politics because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is, of course, rule-based politics, which is what you do at the voting booth. It's very, very rule-based and timeline-based, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, so on and so forth. And full-spectrum practical politics is engaging and taking out an opponent or a system or a corporation, so on and so forth, by any means necessary under the rules or under the laws, but never breaking the rules or never breaking the laws. But to understand anything, we first have to teach you practical politics, which is non-voting politics. The first basics are the art of staying on point or using a talking point and being able to say it over and over again to make your point, not arguing, just making a point. But this is an introduction, again, to Follow the White Rabbit, and Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. This is number, the beginning of 21. And in 21... on this this MP3, this podcast, I'm going to go over some of the different machinations for war. Because I told you there's two options for the Red Hippo. He's going to either let America collapse or he's going to war. Well, there is a third option, the Pink Rabbit banksters, elitesters, and everyone else that aren't already in jail or in trial or whatever, because a full court press has been on them for quite a while. There is a third option. They can jump out windows. I'm surprised more haven't taken that option, believe it or not. But the move is obviously toward war. So I've been asked to comment on this, and since I opened up this topic conversation long ago about this war. The war is, of course, the spotlight is Iran-Israel, but it's broadening out. I expected it to broad out quickly. I didn't expect it to broad out this quickly, but the challenge is that America is starting to collapse. You know, riots could start at any time, and if riots start somewhere like South Central LA or in the inner cities, what will Obama will send in those crack Ranger battalions, and they'll wipe them out probably. Why can Obama do that? Because he's black. For the same reason he could shoot that African, he could order that SEAL team to shoot that African. It doesn't get any flack. That's an interesting point with Obama. He could probably kill Africans with impunity in America, and none of them would know to say anything. But they don't want it to go that route, obviously. Once it goes that route, you went over a line, but you're at a time where everything's falling to pieces. There's nothing you can do about it. Once you go into the time window of 2007, 2008, it's time for change. And the model the planet has been on for 4,000 years of conflict and scarcity is over with. It's coming to a close. And I'm going to talk more about that, because I've talked about conflict and scarcity before, but I'm going to head into these things from different angles. But the news headlines are obvious. You know, get ready to bomb Iran. U.S. and Israel want war with Iran and Gaza. War and another conflict with Gaza. Well, obviously, if you're a soldier in the Middle East or you're a soldier anywhere in the world and you're white, it's not good, but there's nothing I can do about that. When it comes to Ahmadinejad and Iran, they will not choose war. They will go out of their way to not choose war. They will go out of their way to try to find creative solutions. And you should always do that. But once they're attacked, you want to look out. Look out. That is the only thing I know. And it's broad. They're preparing for this in Cuba. Yeah, they're preparing in Cuba. Hugo Chavez is making moves. They're preparing for this in China. They've been preparing for a long time. Pakistan has an internal struggle over the different divisions that control their nukes. Look out. Sounds like a world war to me, doesn't it? It sounds like everyone's going for a clean break. But anyways, Shia Islam, most of you do not know the difference between Shia and Sunni. And I'm not going to go into all the difference from a Muslim perspective, because that's irrelevant to you, really. You just want to know what it means for white rabbits. Well, I've told you before there's two spotlights in white rabbit history, that the question mark, the Hyksos of Egypt. The Hyksos of Egypt are the ones we're talking about in the Old Testament. Yeah, that's what they are. They're redoing stories and making them their own, that type of thing. There's also another episode. The episode is much more fascinating. It's ancient Babylon. Persia, Iran, Iraq, that's all ancient Babylon. And so we're kind of back to the beginning, aren't we? we're back to Babylon. Our troops are stationed back where White Rabbits were when all the shindig started. And in Babylon or in these areas, the dominant Islamic faith is Shia, and Shia is dominated by Iran. 90-95% of Iranian Muslims are Shia. Pakistan, you're going to go 10-15%. India, another 10-15%. However, when you get into Iraq, you're going up to 70% Shia. Turkey would only be like 15%, but Yemen would be up at 40%. Azerbaijan is 75%. Lebanon would be like 55-60%. Bahrain, 75%. United Arab Emirates, Oman, what they call the Shia Crescent coming across there. There are huge numbers of Shia. And the Shia do not control any of the holy sites in Mecca or anything like that. They're controlled by the House of Saud. Now let's go over the House of Saud. The House of Saud has a detente, or what we will, it is a fancy word for agreement. So let's make it simple. They have an agreement. Their agreement says that they get protected by the House of Saud is basically pink rabbits. They do what's bad for the Arabs. Well, that's what a pink rabbit's job is to do. But they basically have an agreement, with Inglespear. They sell their oil in dollars. Once they get their payment in dollars, they recycle those in treasury bonds, treasury notes, and then they take those out and they can invest and do what they want to do, and they end up, a handful of fat cats end up running around somewhere like the United Kingdom buying horse farms and dating white women, that type of thing. The House of Saud is well hated among the Sunni as well as the Shia. The Shia well hate them. And the Shia have been, Ahmadinejad has been running, and also he's a part of another team, aren't they? Yeah, they're part of the Red Hippo. The problem for the House of Saud in this is if Israel and the United States are going at it with Iran, he's got to do something to help. How can he be seen as on the same side as Israel? You know, every day on TV, the Ahmadinejad forces with Iran, as well as the Muslim street, what you think of as the Arab street, the Muslim street, because they're not all Arabs there. But the Persians aren't Arab at all, actually. But anyways, what they show is that, they showed the House of Saud walking with Bush, and obviously Bush is big on Israel. They show the House of Saud selling out his people, so on and so forth, and this has been a problem. It isolates the House of Saud. Al-Qaeda, what you think of as a terrorist organization, I'm not going to go into that, because I don't want white rabbits email me telling me that Al-Qaeda doesn't exist and this and that. Well, that's irrelevant to the topic of this conversation, but one complaint they always make that you will hear the House of Saud, that's a legitimate complaint on the Muslim street. The House of Saud. So the Shia and Ahmadinejad wants to claim the holy sites. To do that, of course, you're talking about getting rid of the House of Saud. But if the House of Saud has an agreement with Anglosphere, and Israel is part of Anglosphere, part of the access of what does the wise men call it? The access of evil, London, Washington, and New York or Wall Street. They're all connected, right? And so the House of Saud will have to fight. But what they're doing is something very, very clever. They're making it a deal between the Sunni and the Shia. They're trying to hide behind the Sunni. How this ends up, I don't know. But it's already started in Yemen. In Yemen, the Sunni, they made a move, or maybe the Shia instigated it. I don't know. Now, the Shia have a famous group. They're called a terrorist outfit called Hezbollah. Calling them a terrorist outfit is probably incomplete, because it makes you think they're just so asymmetrical warfare. At one time they were into asymmetrical warfare, but now they have whole infantry platoons, and they can they stood up and pretty much dominated Lebanese war. They took out tank battalions of Israel. And anytime you do that, you don't have a terrorist unit anymore. You pretty much have an army. A lot of people think in this deal that Iran would only have one shot. Well, I've heard this over the years. Before Israel went into Lebanon a few years back against Hezbollah, the saying was that Hezbollah would only have one shot. Well, we don't really know what we're dealing with here, because this stuff is so wide sky. But Hezbollah had plenty of shots. They had plenty of shots. They weren't accurate shots necessarily, but they were on the ground. Yeah, because we didn't see the whole thing. They were taking out tank after tank after tank after tank, and they have the Chinese weapons. They have the Russian weapons. Maybe you were born just last night. Maybe you just arrived on this third rock from the sun, but those boys don't care much about dying either. You know, if you're sitting in the heat pocket taking out tanks, you're going to have to take some abuse, and they took losses. Don't get me wrong, but they, in my opinion, they beat Israel hands down. They weren't expecting that. No, the Hebrews were not expecting to get that, but they didn't do their homework on what they're dealing with. If you call someone a terrorist army, and if you're thinking in terms of suicide bombings and whatnot, then you walk in and they're infantry trained, and they've been training for decades. For this war you're going to see, they have been training for decades. That's just the fact. So thinking that Iran will only get one shot before they get hammered and this and that, well, Iran's not going to open up the bat. Tragically enough for American troops, there's going to be surprises. And that's what this thing, like in the Lebanon War, there's always surprises. The House of Saud is on the ropes, but what they're worried about is the Persians coming in there and dominating the holy sites and annihilating the House of Saud and maybe even genociding the Arabs. You see, Islam was forced on the Persians. It was forced on the Persians and destroyed their empire and destroyed Zoroastrianism. They've always been ticked off about that. So this should be wild, and it should be big, but you got that Shia Crescent, and that Shia Crescent means Hezbollah. Hezbollah is on a whole nother level of Hamas, because Hezbollah has won a big war. Well, if you win a big war and you stand up tank battalions and that type of thing, you know, the Israelis are pretty well trained for the most part. Heavens knows we give them enough money, but that gives you an idea of how much these guys are ready to fight and willing to fight and ready to fight. Ahmadinejad has said time and time again, he has no interest in war, but he has no problem with fighting. And what they're going to throw out in regards to the next generation, one of the problems for the House of Saud, let's back up. The House of Saud is part of a team, and when you're part of a team, the coach comes out and he tells you to go to war, goes to bat. Well, when Anglosphere was fooling around in Chechnya, Chechnya is a Muslim republic. You had the Sunnis come in there and the Wahhabis. Well, that's all the House of Saud stuff. And so the Arabs came in there out of Saudi Arabia, and they came in there messing around. Well, you're messing with rabbits under the premise that Russia's going to be split up. What happens if it doesn't split up? Well, the problem for the House of Saud started there, in my opinion, because you got guys like Igor Sechin, and I don't know if I pronounce his name right, Igor Sechin. I think it's pronounced Igor Sechin, Igor Sechin, that type of thing. He's listed as one of the most top 50 powerful rabbits in the world. He's probably like in the top 10. He's a name in Russia you don't know about, but when you get into the prosecutions of Khodorkovsky and stuff like that, he is one of Putin's boys, and he's the ones behind it, and he is... he's not someone you want staring down the barrel at him. So that's why you had the House of Saud going over there to the Russians, buying weapons from them, trying to make nicey-nice after Chechnya, because they did some stuff in Chechnya. You know, they sent on the Mujahideen, and they're financing all this stuff. Why? Well, for the same reason Israel went to Georgia. Israel didn't want to go in and help Georgia, but Israel's part of a team. They're going to do what they're told. It's kind of like that, I guess. You get on someone like that's nerves, and... especially when you've got enemies as crazy as Hezbollah. Crazy enough, in other words, willing to die for a cause, willing to die for their people or whatever they feel, the cause is, Islam. And you see why the House of Saud would be concerned. You're not dealing with stupid animals. The Russians, and of course there is a connection there. Yeah, there's a connection there. And so the Shia Crescent is taking form all the way from Persia to Iraq, Iran, Iraq, Syria, all the way over to Lebanon. The whole entire press, I call it the Persian press, and it's coming up against the Sunni and especially the House of Saud. And those oil fields. The oil fields are, of course, and as well as the Hormuz Straits and all that stuff. It's all one big ball, but it's all tied together. But the Sunni have a great deal of numbers globally. The problem with numbers globally is they can't really help you in the Arab Peninsula, can they? They can't really help you because the Arab Peninsula, in other words, this whole entire area is almost 50-50 now. It wasn't at one time, but now it's almost 50-50. Yeah, the massive Sunni populations in Nigeria are no help. They don't have any power anyways. They're mostly third world countries that are Sunni. So it's interesting to see this. What's interesting about Shia, why our enemy wanted Iran, is because if you were going to tweak Islam at all, you would have to have the Shia. They're a lot more moderate in many ways. And they'll go out of their way. Typically, the Iranians and whatnot will go out of their way. I remember after Putin put stuff together, Ahmadinejad sent a variety of different imams into some of these countries on the edge of Russia and told them to calm down. You know, to knock off that stuff, stop causing problems, that they don't want any problems with the Russians, so stop causing problems between Islam and the Europeans and whatnot, which I thought was pretty intelligent. That's creative, though. Say, you know, we're obviously working toward a solution long-term on all these issues, so, you know, don't cause any problems. But they always go out of their way to do that because, well, if you don't want bad reactions, don't create problems. But when you create problems, you know, don't start complaining at reactions and solutions because the basics are the basics. But that's what's going on, so it's going to be huge. You know, and what all they have, who knows? Use your imagination. But you're dealing with powders like Igor Sechin, and you can look him up. I spelled his name for you. And the imagination is run wild. The different type of Russian systems that could be in there and whatnot. And it doesn't take a whole lot. But this idea that Iran, under what you see is what you get, Iran, Hezbollah should only have one shot. But this has never worked that way. And there's been parties preparing for this a long, long time. But it keeps widening out. It keeps widening out all over the world. All these different groups that want to go at it. So in this first round, in this first blow, it's looking like a near-biblical battle, you know, where all these groups want to go at it. What I'm going to do is sit back and watch this first round, because obviously I'm not on a carrier group there, and obviously I'm not in the middle of the Middle East. I'm in the United States, so I'm going to watch this first round and see how this goes, because this is going to be pretty wild. And of course, there's a lot of fear within, somewhere like America and the UK especially, because UK has huge Muslim populations. America has the smallest Muslim population, one of the smallest in the world, which is why you would never want to use America to change Islam. I told you they tried to use America to change Islam. They had that wonderful ideal. The problem is there's no Muslims here. As soon as they open the door to Muslims, you get in more radical elements. It's a no-win situation. That's one of the reasons why they wanted Iran so bad. They don't want to go to war like this. But anyways, in America, you have Muslim populations. The interesting thing about the Muslim populations led in post 1965 is they're right on top of Jewish populations. I mean, literally. And so the Hebrews, of course, would be scared to death. They keep running specials on HBO on that Mumbai massacre. Well, the Mumbai massacre, basically is a bunch of course, Muslim terrorists. It was an asymmetrical attack against a hotel, and they isolated Westerners. A lot of them they shot. I don't know the whole. I don't know all the nitty gritty. But I do know something. They singled out the Jews, and they it reads like one of those South African farm attacks where they attack the white farmers. They butcher, murder in the most heinous ways imaginable, and they isolated the Jews and did that. So there is some amount of fear, and that's why you have those big Ranger battalions all over America, and that type of thing. You have some pretty radicalized elements, obviously, and so that's the first blow. The first blow will happen, and I don't know how broad it's going to be, but with what's going on in Cuba and what's going on with Chavez and what's going on as far as Pakistan and North Korea. I was asked if I thought it would be like the biblical war where a third of the world dies or something like that. Well, it could be just that. It's huge. It's huge. Not Armageddon. You know, gods aren't going to go to war or nothing, but it's huge. And that'll kick things off, and then it's going to get interesting. So I expect to continue to see this clamoring for war. When it's going to be, who knows. But it's not if, it's when. And sometime now, between now and, obviously 2012. I can't imagine them waiting too terribly long because everything's coming to pieces. but there will be a war. I can't be too precise until I see the actual machinations. I mentioned before that there were three revolutions. This would be the coming third revolution or something along those lines. That's my type of thinking. The first one in my mind was the American Revolution. The American Revolution, they had private central banks or public central banks, and they were at full employment. And then they got that shut down, and they went to war with the crown. In my opinion, in the American Revolution, they won the war. They won the battle, basically, but because some elements of that this private central banking came back in or got their foot in the door, they lost the war. World War II is a dicey issue. So let's back up a minute. Let's talk about the model we're in. On this planet, if you will, let me explain it to you like this. The program we're running, and it is just like a computer program, basically. I'm going to explain it to you like this. Imagine white rabbits are in this big computer program, you know, like on The Matrix, Neo in The Matrix, the movie The Matrix. Well, they're running a computer program. This computer program has been running for probably about 3,600 years. This computer program is now malfunctioning. The computer program is based on conflict and scarcity. And right now in your house, if there's a scarcity of money, there's going to be conflict. Any type of scarcity at all causes conflict. They feed on each other. It is an anti-rabbit system. It is not our system. We accelerate in it. We have done well in this type of system because we don't do scarcity. We're the creative rabbits. We're never hungry. If you see a white rabbit starving in the history of the world, it's usually because someone's starving it or some kind of freak disaster. We do not starve. I don't care if you go back 1,000 years from now, you're going to see little fat white rabbits. That's what we do. So much so that right now, most of the world's starving, and in 2009, the world's starving and falling to pieces, whole sections of the planet, and we're getting our pizzas on time. You know, most of the world would beg for a little piece of our chicken fried steak, and we're watching chicken fried steak eating contests every day on TV. You know, this last stage of the Dark Age, we're in the time of decadence, disease, and decay. And everything's just gluttony, but we go over the top with it because we don't do scarcity. We do an abundance. Our creativity has always really helped us in food production. Most of the planet, you know, we solve the biggest problem on this planet, how to have enough food. Most rabbits don't have that luxury. We are. So we're kind of a contradiction here, an apparent contradiction, but nevertheless it is true. It seems like contradiction, but it's true. Most of the white nationals and whatnot, most of the racialists have always known we're very good at conflict. We're great at wars. But that's actually not true. We are not prone to conflict at all. If the white rabbits were prone to conflict, pretty much all the black rabbits in America would be killed because of the crime they created. Most of the leaders of Western civilization would have been killed 1,000 years ago. Some of these families that have been around forever would have been wiped out. We are not prone to conflict. It takes a lot to get them upset. We don't do conflict, and we don't do scarcity. We're not pink rabbits. However, we have a redeeming quality. We're so creative, and we're so good at overcoming scarcity that we dominate in conflict. I'm going to repeat that. It's an old principle. If you can dominate scarcity, if you can overcome scarcity, you will dominate the conflict. The first thing they do in wars is they cut off supply chains. They cut off ammunition. They cut off fuel supplies. Right in World War II, they cut off fuel supplies in Japan. Because if you can dominate scarcity, you can dominate any conflict. The reason we dominated conflict is because we've dominated scarcity. And as our creativity started flowing down as weapons production, well, we're defensive by nature. 80-90% of our survival is based on defense. So much so that it's just ridiculous. We can spread ourselves over the whole top of the planet. No one can do anything with us because our weapons are so outrageous. But we don't use them. Right now in America, you have gazillions of guns, but they don't use them. We are not conflict oriented at all, but the system we've always been able to overcome it enough to where a lot of these other rabbits want to live around us and want to sponge off of it, especially the pink rabbits, banksters and elitesters, and certain parties in charge of Western civilization were their rabbit of choice, you know. because we do abundance so well. We get around scarcity. The type of thinking that has generally prevailed in the modern environmental movements. The environmental, for those that you don't know, things like the Green Party started in Nazi Germany, and it was an environmental struggle. But it was not Malthusian. They didn't look at the world. They looked at the world as something to be taken care of. They did not look at the world necessarily as a fixed asset. Thomas Robert Malthus is the inventor of Malthusian thinking, and he was around in the 17, I think he was born in like 1766, and he basically said that the earth could only handle so big of a population, so on so forth, etc., that everything was real, that resources were always limited. Well, that type of thinking has never once worked for us. It doesn't apply to us. Why? Because we can turn something as abundant as sand that's worthless to everyone else into silicone. If you have a rabbit with those type of capabilities, if you have a rabbit that has access, that has a green goddess, that has a Godzilla, that is that creative, those rules aren't going to apply to us. So there is kind of a weird thing. You know, we have this, all these rabbits, they don't go anywhere. They don't, you know, animals aren't supposed to make progress. No, bears don't progress. Rabbits don't make progress. They stay where they're at. An anthill rises higher, and an anthill, you know, you got these huge anthills in Africa, but they don't go anywhere. 10,000 years from now, they're still going to be anthills. Beaver dams are, beavers are always going to build beaver dams. They're not going to change. But you have these white rabbits. These white rabbits are capable of progress, outrageous levels of progress. We ask questions like, is life worth living? Animals aren't supposed to question their existence, and they're not supposed to make progress. Now, am I saying that all animals are equal and some animals are equal than others? No, that's what the pink rabbit's saying. What I'm telling you is the white rabbits have a weird, something very strange about them. We're not animals. We make progress. We make outrageous levels of progress. But this type of Malthusian thinking that you see pervaded in the environmentalists nowadays is basically... it's been around a long time that there was only a fixed number of assets, and we have to manage our resources because resources are going to run out. Well, that doesn't apply for white rabbits because we turn sand into silicone. We've always produced a new use for old knowledge, something that's lifeless. We transferred to something that gives a lot of life. So World War II was very interesting, the Second Revolution, because here you coming in front of 1950. This is a time when all of our creativity should be exploding. Our green goddess should be taken on a whole new level. And I realize I am jumping around here a little bit, but it's necessary for me to make my point. And what you have here in the machinations way prior to World War II is you have Mein Führer, Adolf Hitler, coming to power. He comes to power. The first thing he does is he gets rid of the private central bank. That's what they did. They got rid of the private central bankers, kicked them out. Now, does he want war? No. The second thing they do is they try to get around scarcity. Now, if you do your homework at all, you're going to see IG Farben, and all these different patents they had for alternative fuel production, that type of thing. Because they know, obviously, common sense, if you can dominate scarcity, you can dominate any conflict. Now, were they looking for war? No, but they had to expect it, because if you throw out private central bankers, and I don't care where you're at on this planet, you throw out the private central banks, they're going to throw a fit, and they're coming after you. You start replacing your oils. When Saddam Hussein starts pricing Iraqi oil from dollars to euros, you're going to war. That's the way they operate, conflict and scarcity, and they cannot let it get out. But what happened, the reason the Third Revolution is not going to be typical, because the Second Revolution, something extraordinary happens. Adolf put down the private central banks. No big deal. That had been done before in the American Revolution. They won the battle, but lost the war long term. Yeah, we lost the war. But that's okay, because the big one's still coming. But in what I call the second revolution, he did something. He went across the board. He got rid of every type of thinking. They tried to get rid of every type of thinking, every shred of anything based on conflict or scarcity within the Third Reich. Now, does that mean they didn't bring back their Prussian high step and all that type of stuff? No. It's kind of like these knights walking around jousting or whatnot. Those are just competitions and that type of thing. But what they did was they got rid of a scarcity mindset. In the science department, many of you have read this, that they burned everything that they considered Jew rabbit physics. Anything having to do with any Jew rabbit physics at all, anything having to do with any type of what they consider Jew rabbit thinking was burnt. In my opinion, it's a little silly because they look like us. We don't look like them. So obviously, whatever they get that's brilliant, they get it from European genes. But they did that. They went over the top on some things. And what they got into, what they were trying to do, is they were trying to jump scarcity. They were trying to get around scarcity at all, altogether. And what we're going to do is talk about if they achieve that. And they've showed it to you right in front of your face. Now, I want to jump over and read a piece for Bob before I go into the couple of latest television specials they put in front of your face. And I'll be making several points along the way. One of Bob's latest pieces, History is Bunk, Historical Fiction is True. Historical fiction is far more accurate than regular history books. I've learned this through reading hundreds of or thousands of both. Once again, as I keep repeating, and I hope you hear, this goes back to one question you must always ask yourself. Why was this information produced? History books are produced to satisfy academics, and we're trained by them. I read along and hit error after error routinely in regular history books, but I have long since stopped trying to correct them because they are not errors anyone reading those books cares about. For example, one book discussed Viking ships. It stated that, surprisingly enough, the only thing that could be traced to the Middle East was the type of sail used. That sail could not be traced at all, but the writer and his readers all took it for granted that if anything existed in the Middle East and in Northern Europe, it was invented in the Middle East. The historical fiction writers have a hard life. Their books are not being read by those who look on the New York Times bestseller and sophistication list. They are being read by several hundred thousand history nuts. If you think I'm being funny, you miss my point, which is critical. A writer of historical fiction who is sloppy pays for it big time. He gets 1,000 letters from paying customers. A lot of other historical fiction writers would love to have asking, how do you trace a particular sail to the Middle East from the remains of a Viking ship? The very idea would fascinate his readers. Can you really trace a Viking ship to the Middle Eastern design? How? And they would not react well to his admitting it was pure horse shit. The question would never occur to a fashionable history reader. He assumes everything was invented in the Middle East. Mommy professor told him so. That is why he says it's surprising that only his part of the ship was like Middle Eastern ones. Hey, bozo, both the Viking ships and the Middle Eastern ships had a bottom, too. Did they build boats with no bottoms until the Christian missionaries got there? This is the part of the gigantic framework of assumptions every college graduate is trained in. Seriously, to say that early Germanic people invented things is what Hitler said. No one would put this in plain English outside this blog, but the fact is that the sophisticated history writer subconsciously sees something anti-Semitic in that assertion. So only the writer of historical fiction will have to send out 1,000 disclaimers of his Middle East nonsense no one would have questioned a mommy professor historian about. Every successful historical fiction has lengthy disclaimers about what it is and what it isn't true in the book. History books only cite the mommy professors they get the truth from. Before Vatican II, many Catholics freely predicted that all Protestants were going to hell. No one minded. But if they said Jews were damned, all hell, pardon the expression, would have busted loose. Even trying to convert Jews to Christianity is an act of PC anti-Semitism. In William Shire's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, he declared that nothing important was invented in the Third Reich because the Jews weren't there. It sold millions of copies and was on the bookshelf out in sight in every mommy professor household. Who but a Nazi would question this statement? My family used to talk about how Hitler seemed to be talking on the radio 24 hours a day. His voice and none of the identifiable scratch that records and wire recorders had. So the word was that he was being kept awake 24 hours a day with drugs. That was how well known the German invention of the tape recorder was. Both the Autobahn and the VW, for which Hitler himself gave the original bug design, were developed in Nazi Germany. Dr. Werner von Braun probably think his team invented some stuff. And then the V1s first hit London. I doubt the Brits said, oh God, it's the same old thing again. The German jets and the first version of the stealth bomber were a bit new in 1944. In fact, it was not until 1980 election campaign that public warned that the first stealth bomber invented, presumably by Jewish Americans. The rise and fall of the Third Reich was required buying for any mommy professor product who wanted it to be with it. Some of them probably read a lot of it, but the line about no Nazi inventions is still there. Who but a Nazi would correct it? Well, as a matter of fact, if it had been historical fiction, several thousand readers would have demanded to know where he got that crap. By contrast, you are not going to see many historical fiction books on people's shelves that they have not read. Only us historical fiction freaks hear of them, much less buy them, and we read each word, and we are fascinated by history. A writer of historical fiction is performing in front of a tough audience. Historians write for mannequins. What Bob is talking about is he's talking about the move toward revisionist history, which is considered, and he's saying a lot of things there, actually. But the reason I read that is because I'm going to talk about a couple of television specials that came out and this stream of information I've talked about, starting in Shark Hunters and continuing in very elaborate display with Joseph P. Farrell. Joseph P. Farrell's taking a lot of hits. He takes hits from everybody, and I'm going to go into why. But one thing he is well-sourced. He's very, very well sourced. When he gives an I.G. Farben patent for lasers in the 50s, you can look up the patents. He's very well sourced. You got to take sources seriously, especially if you can look them up, when he comes into his books like Nazi International. But in World War II, we're going to discuss some things you've seen on TV and some things I've been asked about, and I can talk about it probably far more elaborately than most for a few different reasons. Well, what I'm going to talk about today is, did Mein Führer, did something in the Third Reich get around scarcity? Well, the answer is yes. Yes, they did. They did it in a way, and everyone has seen this, but no one really knows what they're looking at fully. There was a Discovery Channel special, and the Discovery Channel special talked about these different devices from the Third Reich, and they talked about esoteric Nazism. And we've talked about this stuff before, but it's called the Glock. That wasn't the real name, and that means the bell. It looks like a bell. There's also something called a Kecksburg bell. The Kecksburg bell, and let me look it up, it's the same device. The Kecksburg bell, let's see here. Kecksburg UFO incident. Okay. It's in 1965, and it looks like a giant acorn and had some hieroglyphics on it and something like that. Kecksburg is Kecksburg. And I'll come back to this in a minute, but we're going to have a roundabout discussion around all these things because it's important for you to understand as we come into these events. Well, the bell was not a German invention necessarily. I won't go into exactly where they got it from, but it was White Rabbit-ish. It was so. It is a gateway technology. It allows you to test all the different attributes of this unified physics they're bringing out. I won't say anything more about where they got it from because I'm going to come back to this as they show you this more and more. But what I will tell you is this: when this thing first went off, It was hooked underneath that big Venus flytrap thing. This big, it looked like a big Stonehenge type thing in Nazi Germany. When this thing first went off, it did something extraordinary for our race. I believe it now to be true. All the different sources confirm it. But we'll wait until they announce some more things, and then I'll hit you with what it does, what I've heard that it does, and what we know to be true from certain sources. And then I'll go back into this. But one thing it did do, it levitated. In the Discovery Channel special, they're showing this big bell-shaped thing levitating. When the Kecksburg bell flew down, it flew down from somewhere in northern Canada, something like that, as best we know to be true, and it landed. It landed with a bunch of hieroglyphics on it, and that's what the residents say. Well, it didn't have any hieroglyphics on it. What it had was some type of scrolls. And then the army, who was immediately ready for it, arrived minutes later and picked the thing up and took it away. What is a gateway technology? It is a testing technology. But obviously, if you're levitating things, if it's getting around gravity, it's getting around scarcity. you know, coming back into these, into prior to 1950, White Rabbit should be becoming hyper-creative. Our creativity should be flowing. It's always flown with food production. It's always flown with building better swords. So, you know, he's turning them loose. You know, and when you get into the, when you get into this thing, and what happened and what survived, it is so critical simply because of what we know is true around it. We know from what Farrell writes, the bell was considered so important to the Nazis that they killed 60 scientists that worked on the project and buried them in a mass grave. That only reason we know about the bell is that the SS general that was tasked with the murders, Jacob Sporenberg, was tried after the war by a Polish war crimes court for murdering his own people on what subsequently became Polish soil. So it's his affidavit that gives us the story of the Glock, or the bell. The bell has a fascinating name, though. It was constantly referred to as a lantern bearer, the lantern. And I'm going to tell you why someday, but not today. I'll wait till they hit you with some more stuff on TV, because if I tell you now, you wouldn't believe it anyways. But anyways, what it does do was a gateway technology. It helped test these different technologies that what we will label unified White Rabbit physics, and they got this thing going. And this thing was so important that they ended up killing some top scientists who worked on it, and then it disappeared. It disappeared with Mr. Kammler. Mr. Kammler designed anything that was everything in the Third Reich. He never showed up at Nuremberg. He never showed up. No one even wanted to see him. His name just disappeared. Pretty shocking. Of course, to any of his enemies out there, you'd be happy to know he died four times. So you have this big acorn-shaped thing floating around. You have the Keksberg Bell incident floating around, and everyone talks about these UFOs and little green men. Well, there's been a Discovery Channel special lately. This Discovery Channel special is talking about Hitler's stealth fighter. And Hitler's stealth fighter is, of course, a Horton flying wing. I believe that's what it's called. Horton 229 or whatever they're called. And Northrop Grumman rebuilt one, and they tested all the aerodynamics. They tested its stealth capabilities. The fantastic thing, and this was on the National Geographic Channel, the fantastic thing about it was toward the end, they actually showed a simulated bombing run of London and said they would have dominated it. Basically, they did a reenactment of the bombings of London, and they said not only would have London lost, but they did something else too. They revealed a piece of information I've only ever heard coming out of mostly Joseph P. Farrell through his research. It revealed that Goering had told the Horton brothers that they were bringing out a giant one. They were bringing out something called a Horton 18, 218 or something. It was a massive one. It looks identical to our big stealth bombers, our gigantic stealth bombers, B whatever it's called. The big B stealth bombers, the big flying wing stealth bombers we have, and they were bringing it out. And what Hermann Goering, what they revealed in the particular National Geographic channel, was that Goering told the Horton brothers that they had to bring it out by 1946 because they were going to drop nuclear bombs on New York and on Washington D.C. So they're talking about this on National Geographic. The only other one I've heard where nuclear weapons were discussed in relation to the Reich was from Joseph P. Farrell. And of course, in the National Geographic Channel, they again showed a simulated bombing run of Hitler's giant Horton bombers dropping nuclear weapons on New York and on Washington D.C. And obviously, the Nazis would have won. But I think it's the only time in the history of television that they're starting to do this. They're starting to flip things, where you could see, you know, it was like something the little Stormfronters were making. Hitler dropping nuclear bombs on New York and Washington D.C. It's pretty shocking to watch in a National Geographic special. But they revealed that Hermann Goering said they were going to have these big Hortons ready. They wanted to have these big Horton bombers ready, these big flying wings ready. Not the little fighters, but the big flying rings, ready for 1946, so they could drop nuclear bombs on New York and in America, New York and London, or New York and Washington. Well, the only other place I've heard that prior to this show was Joseph P. Farrell had mentioned it, had sourced it. He also went on to say something fascinating, that the nuclear bomb we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we dropped in Japan, was basically a Nazi bomb. It was not our bomb. Well, I thought that was fascinating. Is it true? I don't know, but he's an official source of information, and the reason he's becoming more official is because his stuff's ending up on his stuff's ending up on National Geographic Channel, for more or less. They're alluding to it. They're also alluding to that the special on the Bell, they alluded to several different points that he makes. But to make a long story short, they did get around scarcity. Mr. Farrell's next book, and I'm guessing they're going to be doing a special on this too, is called Roswell and the Reich, the big UFO incident at Roswell. Well, what he did, what Farrell did, was he rebuilt one of the original models of what landed at Roswell from the reproductions. It looks just like a flying wing. What's spectacular about it is that this flying wing that wrecked at Roswell or whatever didn't have little green men on it. It had Nazis, and we've talked about this before. The potential of Nazis wrecking there and everyone in Engels for freaking out. But one thing it does make clear is that it did not have a typical engine in it. It had an engine based on this new type of technology. It had an engine that got around scarcity. So obviously, if you can dominate scarcity, you can dominate any conflict. White rabbits have always got around conflict because we got around scarcity. We do conflict well because we don't do scarcity at all. We are the plentiful rabbits. But in the second, what I call the second revolution, we have a clear incidence. Several different ones, and it's so overwhelming by the time you go through the material that not only were these programs alive after the war, but they moved them. They moved them in two locations. I'm guessing someone like Kammler, someone brilliant like that, split up the programs. One went to the Soviet Union. Several Nazi scientists went to the Soviet Union. Why would they go to the Soviet Union? Well, let's face it, many of the Soviet Union had black programs too, and the science departments there got anything they wanted. They could easily hold on to the mindset to get around it. But the big thing you need to understand about how they did this type of technology was they first got rid of the mindset based on scarcity. Mein Fuhrer's attitude would have been, if you have a white rabbit that is capable of amazing things, we don't want to be limited by any type of Malthusian thinking. There are no limits to us simply because we turn sand into silicone. We know that to be true now. If you have a rabbit that can turn sand into silicone, what's the point of going with some kind of outmoded thinking based on some type of limitations of scarce resources? Well, if you're looking to get around scarce, it just doesn't work for us. And so basically what they did was they divided these programs, and the bell-shaped thing probably came west. It probably came into the Americas. Definitely American black programs. We know that it hit Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, or whatever it was in 65. It's the same type of device. It's a gateway. It's a testing technology. The technology is extremely profound. It's so profound that in one of the talks Joseph P. Farrell has given, he talks about that there's two segments, obviously. There's something that came into the American Black Projects, and we know because Von Braun and whatnot was kind of what you see is what you get in NASA. But there was a whole wing in the American Black Projects, and obviously we don't know anything about them other than they got around scarcity when it came to money. There's a whole wing that went to the Soviet Union. We know about them a little bit more because they did something funny. You see, this is racial technology, because all technology is racial. This technology was so racial that in the 60s, the Soviet wing that was advancing certain elements of this technology, the Soviet wing that was advancing certain elements of this technology kicked out a series of papers in physics, just to see what anyone would say or do. Well, everyone sat there and looked around. You know, you have scientists, legacy scientists, obviously in Anglosphere, specifically American Black Projects, that we don't know about, but we have these ones, and Joseph P. Farrell is producing their physics papers. They kicked out mind-blowing physics papers to see if anyone could follow them. Well, no one could follow it. No one even understood what they were saying, because not only was it a racial technology, not only was this technology racial, but to even advance it, to even see the end, you had to rise out of a scarcity mindset. You had to rise out of a Malthusian mindset. And if you've ever been in a science department in a local university, if you've ever been in an environment, even in like the biology, everything's based on scarcity. Everything's based on Malthusian thinking. Everything's based on we're all equal. Well, we're not. We're white rabbits. We're radically different. So what was funny is they released it from the Soviet Union end just to see who else could pick up on it. No one could even understand it. No one could catch on. No one even questioned it. It was like mind-boggling stuff, and that no one could even follow it. So that's how comedy this stuff was. And we know now that elements of Anglosphere, and we're not necessarily talking about the ones in the Black Projects, but elements of Anglosphere, maybe the Israelis and whatnot were able to machine certain parts of it. It's very sophisticated and very destructive, even in that sense, but they couldn't take it. They couldn't take it beyond a certain point because of a pink rabbit mindset. They couldn't see the end. And, of course, Farrell asserts, and I'm going to assume this true, it's coming out of Shark Hunters vis-a-vis Joseph P. Farrell, that there was a 10,000 square mile place in South America bordering Argentina and Chile, something like that, the size of Massachusetts, that the National Socialists had. And so you have one part in America and probably Canada, Black Projects. You have another part in the Soviet Union. You have a third body that's basically putting everything together. In other words, they blow apart the structure, they compartmentalize and decompartmentalize, and they start putting things together. But to advance the technology to see the whole end, what they found out was that it was so racial that they could bring physics papers out in front of the world, and it was so racial that if you didn't have a proper white rabbit thinking, if you couldn't think like a white rabbit, if you didn't have a proper framework, even if you were a brilliant Aryan rabbit scientist, you couldn't see it. How funny is that? That's comedy. So when asking me about this third revolution, there's some Malthusian type of thinking is best demonstrated if you've ever been in college economics. In college economics, the first thing I did when reading a college economics book when I was like a freshman is a ceteris paribus. Ceteris paribus is Latin for all things being equal. All things are not equal because we're not equal. That's what they tell you. If you go to apply to a police station, if you're a white rabbit, you want to be a cop in the United Kingdom, in London, they're going to say you're not equal. There's these white nationalists and different racialist groups that wear the t-shirts, not equal. They'll tell it to your face. I don't think we really realize what they're saying, but we're not in any way, shape, manner, or form. But when you're talking about how this thing may go, there's some unquantifiables because they escape scarcity. And if you can escape scarcity, you will dominate conflict. And let me put it to you in very simple terms. If Yosemite Sam rabbit is out in the West, and he's in a big gunfight with a big enemy. The enemy attacks him. He's in a gunfight, and they're busy. He's got some white rabbit scientists that are busy perfecting things. Well, if this scientist comes up to him toward the end of the war, and he's obviously losing bad because they're wailing on him. You know, he's in Texas, and Germany was about the size of Texas. And Germany, being the size of Texas, was getting wailed on by the Soviet Union and all of Anglosphere. But he, you know, Yosemite Sam has these white rabbit scientists that come to him from this stuff with all kinds of wild stuff. And if Yosemite Sam can go from dealing steel to, let's say, instead of a six-shooter to a laser shooter, dealing steel to dealing light, well, he gets around scarcity. He's no longer exploding gunpowder. You remember, we're back to the difference between explosion and implosion. Explosion is something gunpowder does. Implosion is something that a laser is going to do. You can deal light to infinity. There is no scarcity there. When it comes to bullets, you're always going to be prone to scarcity in regards to supply and everything else. So if Yosemite Sam could wake up one morning and go from a six-shooter to a light shooter, that's pretty profound. If Yosemite Sam doesn't have to worry about gas supplies, and he has a perpetual engine, you're dealing with a whole nother level. If you can get around scarcity, you're going to dominate conflict. He's also, even if he lost the battle, even if he's got wailed on, he would have good negotiating potential. His job at that point is to survive. The funny thing about the red hippopotamus is he cannot create. He can only make things his own. That's true. The evil cannot create. If you're a Christian, in the Bible, it talks about the devil. The devil cannot create. He can only make things of his own. Everything he touches, he makes his own. Well, red hippo. That's the red hippo. He's evil. He can't create. He's unnatural. And creation is a natural act. So as we became more creative, the pink rabbits became more destructive. Yeah, they ran through America faster than anyone could see. someone emailed me and asked me what I meant by Nazis and the CIA promoting Jews. What exactly I meant? Well, what if they did? What they would be saying is, you're so destructive, and this place is going to be destroyed. So let's just help them, because they're going to mow through this place in no time flat post 1950. Well, and they did. The place between black rabbits and brown Mexican rabbits and pink rabbits, it's a place that's even mowed over. But what's funny is, you're dealing with our creativity had created a type of technology, and I firmly believe this, that was so creative, that was so white rabbitish, that you couldn't follow it unless you were racially connected to us. And you couldn't even follow it then unless you could take on a non-Malthusian mindset, what I will call a non-Malthusian mindset. Bob Whitaker, Mr. Whitaker, is so important. Old Bob is so important because it is the only racialist blog, only white blog, white rabbit blog in the world where you can read and get consistent food that is not Malthusian. Those rules for environmentalists that ceteris paribus, all things being equal, they work for anthills, they work for brown rabbits, they work for black rabbits, they don't work for us. We make such outrageous progress. But I can't really predict the third revolution, because the second revolution, why we lost horrific numbers. And Yosemite Sam would. If Yosemite Sam had a light shooter and he got around scarcity, he just would have to survive long enough to develop it for a couple years. This technology is so profound that it has five different capabilities. In other words, you'd be talking about, let me put it in real space age terms. Imagine Yosemite Sam, a scientist, comes up to him with a laser shooter. They can also immediately put a force field around him and stuff like that. This technology is that profound. It's game changing. So he would have to survive by any means necessary long enough to advance it to the stage to pull a radical negotiation like Roswell. And then it would be over. Because if you can dominate scarcity, you can dominate conflict. Not only that, you're dealing with an enemy that can't create, and you're dealing with the technology that they found out in the 60s that was so profound that people could only follow it to certain steps. They could only machine parts of it, but they can never see the end unless they could take on a pure, what we'll call white rabbit thinking, or a non-Malthusian concept. You know, we're sitting here talking on an internet. Most white rabbits, because of this Malthusian framework, even the white nationalists cannot think far ahead. It's kind of inhibited our struggle. They can't envision white rabbits getting on a plane, all leaving, going into a Russian-German axis. They can't envision countries splitting up. They can't envision, because there's a certain contradiction in their thinking. Race is real, but we're going to find out how real it is in this third revolution. And it's important to spend as much time as you can trying to get out of the mindset. And it is difficult. It's difficult because you're in a system that permeates it. You're in a system that permeates it from top down. If you come home and you don't have a job, there's scarcity, there's going to be conflict in the home. Yeah. The first thing they did prior to World War II is Hitler got rid of any sense of scarcity at all for white rabbits. That's basically what they were doing. They made sure everyone had what they need, and they wanted to stoke that creativity. In my opinion, they were brilliantly successful at that. They were not brilliantly successful at avoiding war, but they would have had to know, because pink rabbits would not let that slide. When you start talking about alternative fuels and stuff like that, they know what they're doing. They know where they're going with that. They know way more about us than we could ever hope to as far as our history. We don't know our history, so you got to have an open mind to this type of stuff. But when I see Hitler's stealth fighter and all this information coming out on National Geographic Channel, I see Farrell putting out a book, Roswell and the Reich. You know, the funny thing is, when it comes to this bell-shaped thing, it is going to be probably the most profound thing our race has ever done, ever. It'll mean everything. And as they reveal more stuff to you, I'll tell you its original names. I'll tell you where they got the ideal from. I'll even go into what it does, what's so profound about it when it first goes off. But it is a distinct racial technology. And so because I don't fully understand everything behind the machinations of the second revolution, other than someone got around scarcity, I don't understand how the third one's going to go. I have some ideals. I have some ideals, but it could get pretty wild, obviously, because although they're not in, they're obviously not in Argentina. They haven't been there since the 60s. Where'd they go? I don't know. I don't know. The theories behind it are a little too wild, but that bell-shaped thing went off for the first time. It went off about 70 years ago or something like that in the Third Reich. When I say went off, it went off. They charged it up using a massive amount of electricity, and when it went off, it killed everything around. It killed scientists, and they knew they were going to die. Most of them assumed they would die because they didn't fully know understand this technology's capabilities. Obviously, if you never have done it before, you have only a vague idea of how to protect yourself from it. But it is a profound thing for our race. So getting out of the Malthusian mindset is very, very important. And as I transition into 22 and I talk about consistency and continuity and white rabbit behavior, we're going to come back to these topics because they're all important. But understanding what you are and what you aren't is half the battle. We're not conflict oriented, but we dominate conflict because we dominate scarcity. If you can walk up with a handful of different technologies and wipe out whole populations, well, you're going to obviously dominate any conflict. But we're not obviously conflict prone. We're never going to be. They will typically go away from conflict. They can defend themselves. They can defend themselves because by and large, we are defensive creatures. White rabbits can't survive if they don't defend themselves. If they don't have territory, they can defend. But don't buy all into all the fear. Military is 2 points. It's wide sky, and what you see is what you get. Well, our military has been wide sky forever. And 7 years ago, someone in your race brought together something so profound, floating around in Nazi Germany, that it could not be advanced by anyone anyone that wasn't an Aryan rabbit. And they knew that for a fact because they released papers in the 60s from the Soviet Union that no one could follow. And the Chinese are just now digging through all this stuff. And so it's kind of interesting. And we'll come back. I'll come back to and talk about more of this in the actual in number 22, and 21 and 22 are going to go together. But it's important to you, for you to understand that Bob Whitaker is very, very special to me, in my opinion, simply because it's non-Malthusian. Some guys have commented, well, he never talks about any violent confrontations, because if you do scarcity well, and we do scarcity well, if you know that, violence is not a problem. You know, the only thing you know to be true is that the white rabbits are anywhere from 10 to probably more like 7% of the world's population. We're spread out over the whole top of the planet. We have weapons the likes of which most of us can't fathom, and those are just the ones we know about. And I'm not even talking about anything behind the scenes like this DeGlock thing or what you can create with it. For some reason, we don't have a home. And you have a massive amount of negative conditioning. You remember all these topics I'm talking about are interrelated and connected. And we're coming into a time period where our creative abilities are going to be magnified a lot more than anything we've seen in World War II, and we don't really know. But one thing we do know, when you see that thing floating on TV, I was asked what I thought the Keksberg Bell would say Germanic, most likely some kind of scroll language or some type of Teutonic scrolls or something. What it says is freedom. Because if a white rabbit can get around scarcity on that level, if you can get around not having munitions, if you can get around not needing gasoline, well, then all you need is some kind of nest to nest in to advance it this way or that way. And this technology is all interrelated. You don't have to redevelop it. You know, like most of the time we're used to seeing defensive equipment. You know, they develop this type of new gun. It has to have this type of new ammunition. You're talking about a whole new level. Where something can go immediately from an energy source to a and be weaponized 5 ways a Sunday, all with a click of a switch or with a little modification. You're dealing with something very, very white rabbitish, very creative, very dynamic. But it becomes unquantifiable what's going to go on, because we don't really fully know what's out there. But one thing I do know to be certain is that we got around scarcity. And they're just waiting for certain events. But we'll see soon. So when it comes down to direct machinations for the Third Revolution, most people would you know, assume some kind of a conflicts in the street of America and stuff like that. Well, we could see anything after this war, and I'm assuming there's going to be a war with Iran, not if but when. We could see anything. You could see anything. But this first round, I'm going to sit in my white rabbit hole, and I'm going to watch, and I'm going to see what's going on, because every single one, whether it be the American Revolution or World War II, it ended up being a lot more interesting than it made the history books. And we're seeing this all come to fruition right in front of your face when you see the Discovery Channel specials and the National Geographic specials and the stuff coming down the lines. When you see something end up on National Geographic, you look to where you first heard it in the sources, then you follow who most recently put it all together in his best source. And that stream of information is flowing pretty clearly. And it's going to be interesting to watch this unfold. But in as it starts, I'm going to sit back in my white rabbit hole, and I'm always on a consistent message. And we'll go back to this because we need to put back together any type of ethnic leadership. And you do that with a consistent message. We can't really say anything we want in Germany without going to jail. And that's why talking points and whatnot are important. And we're going to continue this discussion on 22 when we talk about white rabbit consistency and continuity and behavior. But if you think all hope is lost, that's the ultimate in Malthusian thinking. If we were brown rabbits, it would be. But as long as you're looking down and you're still a white rabbit, all hope is not lost, because you don't know what's out there, and they're putting stuff right in front of your face. That's very blatant. It's very blatant. So we don't know the future. You know, if we were to sit back 50 years from now and say that we're going to have this, and Horace would go back in time 50 years ago and say we're going to, even around a good racial thinker, even around someone that wouldn't appear to be Malthusian, and would say we're going to have this internet and all these silicone chips and everything else, it was going to be made from silicone, we're going to take sand and make it into silicone, so on and so forth, they couldn't imagine the future. It's very difficult to get out of the box. It's very difficult to see the machinations. But it all comes around thinking like a white rabbit and not falling back into Malthusian thinking. And it is difficult when you don't have, or when everything in the society is not made for white rabbits. It's made for pink rabbits. So I've also got emails regarding what type of economic system. Well, the economic system is based on conflict and scarcity. America in the 50s, there was very few regulations and very few taxes, so it didn't really inhibit our creativity. However, it was still at root a private central bank. It was still at root a system based on conflict and scarcity, because the whole entire globe is based on that. Americans didn't mind so much until they started taxing and regulating. And Europe never understood why we hated taxes and regulation until they had a bunch of Muslims move in. Now that they have a bunch of Muslims move in, they don't like taxes either, because they know where the taxes are going to support the brown populations. Kind of interesting. But you see, regulations and taxation, what you tax, you get less of. These are all create some type of scarcity on some level. If they were to regulate the internet, it would make it more scarce. That's kind of common sense. If they were to tax it, they would make it more scarce. What you tax, you get less of. Just like take-home pay. When they tax it, you get less. These are all elements of scarcity, and white rabbits hate it. Yeah, they hate it. If you were to white rabbits, male and female, were to vote on taxes in America, they would overwhelmingly vote it down to nothing. Probably in Europe right now too, because they got brown rabbits. The reason America was ahead of the curve in hating taxes, because we knew the money would go to brown rabbits. Well, that's just a fact, and it has, and it hasn't worked. You know, the schools in these areas cost 30, 40 grand a year to send these kids to school, and it's a waste. Because race is real. They need something totally different for them. What's been interesting, and one last point here, and this has everything to do with World War II, in my opinion, when the Taliban got elected, there's a huge host behind them that is obviously what I call old world liberals. And old world liberals are East Coast liberals, mainly WASP, some Jews, but there's a lot of WASP in there, the Jimmy Carters and whatnot. And typically these old world liberals, they hate funding for NASA, they hate funding for anything for space, because they figure money for space programs is money for white people. They don't like that. They like money for brown people. You know, these self-hating, what I call the schwa babies, the self-hating white baby boomers. And Bob could tell you stories. He had to fight for space money for certain telescopes and whatnot. Anything having to do with that is always critical for our race. But they don't like it because, one, it's racial, and it's just money, taking money away from brown people. So Obama came in and he talked about cutting funding for NASA. You might remember this. He talked about getting rid of funding for NASA altogether. Well, a few days after that, and all his supporters, that's obviously, you know, not his ideal. That's his supporters' ideals, because he doesn't have any ideals. You know, I'm asked to describe Obama. You know, old Bob says it best. How do we describe nothing? He doesn't have anything. He's told what to do. He's an actor. And so anyways, they told him to quit funding for NASA, stop funding. He talked about stopping funding NASA, cutting back that funding and everything else. You know, more money for brown children. Same old, same old. And next thing you know, something came through his office, and he stood to attention, and he called in NASA, and he wasn't cutting funding. They were expanding funding for this and that. Something apparently scared him. Or something changed radically, and then they had all this NASA stuff come out afterwards. So I'm expecting some interesting things to come out of that panel, and it has everything to do with this bell-shaped thing, the de Glock, the lantern, that they called it, the lantern bearer, Project Kronos. It has everything to do with that. It has everything to do with World War II, and it has everything to do with the fact that our race is the creative race. The white rabbits are the creative rabbits. We're the only rabbits that make radical progress. And that we got around scarcity in a way that no one's been able to touch. Joseph P. Farrell, in this, he gave his first UFO conference, and apparently he was pretty leery, because his thing is, it's not little green men out there. It's what you see is what you get. It's Nazis, and there's always been the UFO community. I guess they say that, well, a lot of these projects are governments. You know, governments produce these next generation crafts and fly around, and people see them. That's kind of common sense. I'm sure we've been doing that. They have them on Discovery Channel. And there's another one. The other one was kind of more entertaining. They think it's little green men, because something out there is far more advanced, and no one can get near them. No one can get near the technology. The technology is a step ahead. The technology is like more complete, is how it's described. And maybe there are little green men in this. But Farrell's response was, it's National Socialists. It is what was developed out of World War II. And they didn't like that. They didn't like hearing that little green men didn't land at Roswell. They want to believe in fantasies. And we'll touch on this topic again in 22. And 22 will be out shortly after this, because they go together. But I can't get specific on the Third Revolution, because however mind-blowing I could get, I'm sure it's going to top it, because this stuff always does. But it goes right back to that bell. It is racial. It's so racial it couldn't be duplicated in many forms. It's so racial they couldn't get beyond machining it. It's so racial, not only do you have to be a white rabbit, but you got to take on the correct mindset. Kind of funny. Kind of interesting. And, you know, old Bob's stuff is amazing, because once you download the software, you're going to get that good, healthy white rabbit virus. It just takes some consistency and working on your thinking. And it is difficult in this type of society, but it is nonetheless doable. But if you understand race is real, you should really understand that Malthusian type of thinking on any level does not apply to us. It applies to beavers. It applies to bears. It applies to anthills. It does not apply to white rabbits. You know, most of these other civilizations brown out, end, never come back. Our civilizations end, and then we go into consolidation, and then we build bigger civilization. There's never one time where our civilizations have not peaked at a higher level, and that's in the middle of a dark age. Yeah, everything we've had have peaked at a higher level, a higher and higher level. You know, we're a lot bigger and better than Rome, so on and so forth, etc. But I'll be back with you at 22, and we're gonna carry on this topic of conversation. I wanted to put this stuff in there because they're hitting you with so much stuff. I wanted you to be ready. They're putting this stuff out there, but you don't really know what it means from a racial perspective. What it tells me when you see that thing floating on the screen is that someone jumped scarcity. What it tells me when I see the IG Farben patents for lasers, that someone jumped scarcity. And we've always dominated conflict over the past few hundred years simply because we dominate scarcity. We don't do scarcity. We do abundance. We're the fat rabbits, right or wrong. It's what we do. We've never once had a problem with food production, so much so when a white rabbit moves out of Africa, they all starve. Well, they shouldn't be feeding the bears to begin with, should they? No, we don't feed the bears. But this is going to be interesting, watching the machinations come and what's revealed. And it will be, as it is revealed, I'll try to give you a heads up on the direction it goes racially and where the information comes from. But we got a source of information coming pretty clear here, It's a stream of information coming clearer and clearer. And I'll be back with you on 22. This is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Follow the White Rabbit, again, is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is practical because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is voting politics or rule-based politics. And the ultimate, of course, is full-spectrum practical politics, engaging and taking down an opponent, a system, by any means necessary, within the rules, within the law, but never breaking them. And this is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Thank you for listening.